بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the most merciful, the most compassionate.
ألف لام را تلك آيات الكتاب الحكيم.
ألف لام را. These are the verses of the book overflowing with wisdom.
Alif Lam Ra. These are the verses of the book overflowing with wisdom.
This introductory statement carries a subtle note of warning. For the unbelievers, out of their sheer stupidity, looked upon the Quran which was presented to them by the Prophet, peace be upon him, as merely a literary masterpiece, an embodiment of spellbinding poetic imagination, a fascinating discourse on a very sublime, elusive plane in the manner of soothsayers. The unbelievers are told that such notions are pure misconceptions. On the contrary, the Quranic verses are part of a book which abounds in wisdom. Hence, if they disregard the Quran, they are merely depriving themselves of a treasure house of wisdom.
أَكَانَ لِلنَّاسِ عَجَبًا أَنْ أَوْحَيْنَا إِلَىٰ رَجُلٍ مِّنْهُمْ أَنْ أَنذِرِ النَّاسَ وَبَشِّرِ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَنْ أَنذِرِ النَّاسَ وَبَشِّرِ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَنَّ لَهُمْ قَدَمَ صِدْقٍ عِندَ رَبِّهِمْ قَالَ الْكَافِرُونَ إِنَّ هَذَا لَسَاحِرٌ مُبِينٌ.
Does it seem strange to people that we should have revealed to a man from among themselves, directing him to warn the people who lie engrossed in heedlessness, and to give good news to the believers that they shall enjoy true honor and an exalted status with their Lord? Is this so strange that the deniers of the truth should say, "This man is indeed an evident sorcerer"?
And to give good news to the believers that they shall enjoy true honor and an exalted status with their Lord?
The unbelievers are asked why they are astonished that a human being has been designated to warn other human beings. Would it have been reasonable to designate some angel, jinn, or animal rather than a human being to warn other human beings? Similarly, is there anything weird or exotic about the appointment of a prophet? For if people are found engrossed in error and are oblivious to the truth, what then is truly strange? That their Creator and Lord should make arrangements to guide them or let them continue stumbling in their error? And if divine guidance is made available to human beings, does it not stand to reason that it is those who follow rather than those who reject it that deserve to be held in honor and esteem? Those who express their astonishment at this should reconsider what is that truly merits astonishment.
This man is indeed a plain sorcerer.
The unbeliever's allegation that the Prophet, peace be upon him, is a sorcerer is devoid of even an iota of truth. The mere fact that a person, by dint of his capacity to express himself effectively, influences people and captivates their hearts and minds does not warrant being called a sorcerer. What is worth considering is the purpose for which he employs his oratorical skill and the kind of influence that his oration has on the audience. Any orator who uses his skill for an evil purpose will naturally be considered a demagogue, an unbridled and irresponsible speaker, for his only interest lies in casting a spell over his audience. Even if he might have to resort to making false and exaggerated statements or saying things that are altogether unjust, the discourse of such speakers is bereft of all wisdom, for all it aims to do is to hoodwink and bamboozle the gullible masses. Such speakers have no coherent set of ideas to offer. What they say is full of contradiction and incoherence. Such speakers lack moderation and lean towards extremism, for their purpose is to prove their capacity to spellbind their audiences by verbal flamboyance or to intoxicate them with inflammatory eloquence in order to pit one group against another. Such oratory is not conducive to moral improvement, and the lives of the audience are by no means reformed. neither does the eloquence of such speakers bring about any healthy change in the outlook of the audience, nor in the quality of their lives. In fact, such eloquence may even have an evil and corrupting influence. In sharp contrast to all this, the Prophet's oration is characterized by wisdom and coherence, balance and moderation of the highest order, and strict adherence to the truth. Each word of the Prophet, peace be upon him, is pregnant with purposiveness and manifests a keen sense of proportion. In addition, all his oration is directed to just one purpose, to guide and reform mankind. In all that he says, there is no trace of any concern for worldly interests, personal, familial, or national. He only warns people against the evil consequences of their heedlessness and invites them to something that would lead to their own well-being. Furthermore, the effect of the Prophet's oration on his audience is radically different from that of sorcerers, for all those who accept the Prophet's message undergo a change for the better. Their moral conduct improves, and all in all, they become oriented to righteousness and benevolence. It was therefore for the Prophet's detractors to consider whether sorcerers achieve such results and whether their professional skills are directed towards such noble purposes.
إن ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يدبر الأمر ما من شفيع إلا من بعد إذنه ذلكم الله ربكم فاعبدوه أفلا تذكرون.
Surely, your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, then established himself on the throne of his dominion, governing all affairs of the universe. None may intercede with him except after obtaining his leave. Such is Allah, your Lord. Do therefore serve him. Will you not take heed?
Then established himself on the throne of his dominion, governing all affairs of the universe.
There is no reason to believe that after having created everything, God chose to consign himself to the limbo of unconcern. On the contrary, after his great act of creation, he established himself on the throne and holds the reins of the entire universe, so that he not only reigns, but in fact also effectively rules over the universe. The Quran considers it a colossal error, an error to which the ignorant have succumbed, to believe that after creating the universe, God either left it to run on its own or entrusted its affairs to others to govern it as they please. On the contrary, the Quran emphasizes that it is God who is directing all the affairs of his creation, that all power effectively rests with him alone. The Quran constantly drives home the point that God alone has all authority, so that all that takes place in the universe, or in any part of it, takes place by his command or his leave. God's relationship with the universe is not simply that he created it. Rather, the reins of the universe are with him, and he is in effective and continual control of its affairs. It is he alone who keeps the universe in existence, and it is he alone who directs it as he pleases.
None may intercede with him except after obtaining his leave.
No one is in a position to interfere with God in his governance of the universe, or has the power to effectively intercede with God on anyone else's behalf, and to prevail upon him to change any of his decisions. Nor is anyone in such a position of power with God that his intercession would make or unmake anyone else's destiny. The utmost that a person can do is to pray to God. However, the acceptance or non-acceptance of such prayers rests solely with him. No one is so powerful that his desire will, of necessity, always prevail with God, nor does anyone's intercession bind God to act according to the former's desire.
Such is Allah, your Lord. Do therefore serve him.
After emphasizing the given fact of God's lordship in the first part of the verse, man is now informed of its logical consequences. Since all authority rests solely with God, it is incumbent upon man to serve Him exclusively. God's lordship embraces the threefold attributes of His being: A, the sustainer; B, the master; and C, the sovereign. In like manner, the term ibadah embraces the threefold corresponding implications that man should A, worship; B, serve; and C, obey God. Ibadah in the first sense implies that since God alone is the sustainer, it is to Him that man should offer his thanks. It is to Him that he should address all his prayers. It is to Him that he should bow in love and devotion and reverence. In the second sense, ibadah denotes that since God alone is the master, it behoves man that he should live as his slave, that he should not act independently of, let alone in defiance of him, that he should refuse to be the slave of anyone other than God, both in thought and in deed. In its third sense, ibadah means that since God alone is the sovereign, man should obey his command, follow his law, and abstain from arrogating sovereignty to himself or anyone other than him.
Will you not take heed?
Since man has been informed of the fundamental truths and has been shown the right way, there is no justification for him to remain engrossed in those false conceptions which have caused him to act in a manner altogether inconsistent with the reality.
إليه مرجعكم جميعا وعد الله حقا إنه يبدأ الخلق ثم يعيده ليجزي الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات بالقسط والذين كفروا لهم شراب من حميم وعذاب أليم بما كانوا يكفرون.
To him is your return. This is Allah's promise that will certainly come true. Surely, it is He who brings about the creation of all, and He will repeat it, so that He may justly reward those who believe and do righteous deeds. And those who disbelieve may have a drought of boiling water and suffer a painful chastisement for their denying the truth. To Him is your return.
The Prophet's teachings comprise two fundamental doctrines. A, that God alone is man's Lord and hence man should worship Him, and B, that man is bound to return to his Lord in the next life, wherein he will be made to render an account to his Lord. This particular verse focuses on the second of these two doctrines.
Surely, it is He who brings about the creation of all, and He will repeat it.
This Quranic statement combines the enunciation of a basic doctrine with its supporting argument. The doctrine that is being enunciated here is that God will resurrect man. This is supported by the argument that it is God who brought about the creation in the first place. All those who believe that the original creation was an act of God can neither consider it impossible nor irrational to believe that God can and will create afresh. The only ones who might be inclined to deny such a possibility are those atheists who, presumably out of aversion to the irrational religious practices of the priests, have succumbed to the absurd doctrine of creation without a creator.
And those who disbelieve may have a drought of boiling water and suffer a painful chastisement for their denying the truth.
The present verse sets forth the rationale of resurrection. The preceding verses had conclusively established that resurrection is possible, that there is no reasonable ground to dub it as a far-fetched idea. Drawing upon the above, the verse under consideration points out that the requirements of justice and reason can only be fulfilled by resurrection, and that this calls for a repetition of the original act of creation by God. The point that is being made here is that those who accept God as their one and the only Lord and truly live in service and devotion to Him deserve to be fully rewarded for their righteous conduct. Likewise, those who reject the truth and act according to their own whim deserve to be duly punished for their unrighteous conduct. The present life is so constituted that reward and punishment are not being meted out and cannot be meted out in the manner described above. This is a plain fact, and one which is evident to all except those who are obstinate. This being the case, reason and justice demand fresh creation in order that such reward and punishment be meted out.
هو الذي جعل الشمس ضياء والقمر نورا وقدره منازل لتعلموا عدد السنين والحساب ما خلق الله ذلك إلا بالحق يفصل الآيات لقوم يعلمون.
He it is who gave the sun radiance and the moon light, and determined the stages for the waxing and waning of the moon, that you may learn the calculation of years and the reckoning of time. Allah has created all this with a rightful purpose rather than out of play. He expounds His signs for the people who know.
إِنَّ فِي اخْتِلَافِ اللَّيْلِ وَالنَّهَارِ وَمَا خَلَقَ اللَّهُ فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ لَآيَاتٍ لِقَوْمٍ يَتَّقُونَ.
Surely, in the alternation of the night and the day, and in all that Allah has created in the heavens and the earth, there are signs for the people who seek to avoid error of outlook and conduct. There are signs for the people who seek to avoid error of outlook and conduct.
This provides yet another argument in support of the doctrine of the hereafter. The argument is derived from the orderly nature of the universe. This vast universe, the handiwork of God, is spread out before our eyes. It is full of signs of God's power and wisdom, such as those which underlie the sun and the moon and the alternation of night and day. Even a superficial glance at the universe is enough to convince one that the creator of this enormous universe is not at all like a child who creates something to play with and after enjoying it for a while whimsically destroys it. For it is quite evident that every act of the creator is characterized by order and wisdom, and that a strong purposiveness underlies everything, even a speck of dust. Now, since the Creator is all-wise, as is evident from His creation, it is absurd to assume that He who has also invested man with reason, moral consciousness, and free will not call man to account for his conduct, that He will altogether disregard the need for retribution arising from man's responsibility, which in turn stems from his inherent rational and moral endowments. Apart from expounding the doctrine of the hereafter, the above verses also adduce the following three arguments in support of that doctrine. First, a persuasive case is made out in support of the possibility of a second life. The basis of the argument is that the creation of man in the first instance is indicative of God's creative power. Second, the next life is needed in order that man might be rewarded or punished in consideration of his performance, whether good or bad. Both justice and reason seem to call for a new life wherein everyone would be able to see in a fair manner the consequence of his deeds. Third, that the next life, which is a requirement of justice and reason, will certainly come to pass. This is because the Creator, who created man and the universe, is all-wise, and it is inconceivable that such a being will not respond to an unmistakable requirement of justice and reason. After careful consideration, it appears that the above are the only possible arguments that might be adduced, and they suffice to establish that there is life after death. The only possible question that remains, after having established that the next life is demanded by both reason and justice, and also that it is a requisite of God's wisdom, is whether it is possible to visually observe the next life in the manner in which people observe other objects. Now, it should be clearly understood that this inability will remain during the present phase of existence. The reason for it is that God asks man to believe in certain truths, and such a demand in respect of objects which can be observed with human eyes would be utterly meaningless. The test to which man has been put consists precisely of this: whether man can affirm certain truths which belong to the suprasensory realm by the use of his rational faculties. Another point which has been stated in this context also deserves serious consideration. This is embodied in the following Quranic statement. He expounds his signs for the people who know. Yunus 10:5. And in all that Allah has created in the heavens and the earth, there are signs for the people who seek to avoid error of outlook and conduct. Yunus 10:6. This means that God, in His infinite wisdom, has seen to it that in the multifarious phenomena of existence, there should be plenty of signs which betoken the hidden realities underlying that phenomena. However, not all men will be able to benefit from those signs. Those who will be able to benefit are those, A, who liberate themselves from prejudices and seek knowledge with the help of the natural endowments bestowed upon them by God, and B, those who are keen not to fall into error and who earnestly seek to adhere to the right way.
إِنَّ الَّذِينَ لَا يَرْجُونَ لِقَاءَنَا وَرَضُوا بِالْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا وَاطْمَأَنُّوا بِهَا وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ عَنْ آيَاتِنَا غَافِلُونَ
Surely, those who do not expect to meet us, who are gratified with the life of the world and content with it, and are heedless of our signs,
أولئك مأواهم النار بما كانوا يكسبون.
Their abode shall be the fire in return for their misdeeds. Their abode shall be the fire in return for their misdeeds. Here again, a doctrine has been put forth along with its supporting argument. The statement that is being made here is that rejection of the doctrine of the hereafter necessarily entails the punishment of hell, and the argument that is being proffered in support of it is that those who are oblivious to the hereafter commit, because of their disbelief in it, evil deeds which can only lead them to suffering, the torments of hell. This argument is corroborated by the entire record of man's past. It is quite clear that the lives of those who do not believe that they will not be held to account by God for their deeds, who work on the assumption that life is merely confined to the span of worldly existence, who measure human success or failure only in terms of the extent of material comfort, fame, and power that a person is able to enjoy, who under the influence of such materialistic notions do not even care to pay attention to those signs of God which point to reality, assume an altogether wrong direction with the result that their life is vitiated. Hence they live a totally unbridled life, develop the worst possible character traits, and fill God's earth with injustice and corruption, with sin and transgression, and ultimately end up meriting the punishment of hell. It will be seen that whereas the three arguments mentioned earlier were of a theoretical nature, the above argument about the hereafter is drawn from human experience itself. Although in the present verse the argument is found only in an implicit form, it is spelled out at several other places in the Quran. The argument essentially is that unless man's character rests on the consciousness and conviction that he will have to render an account for all his deeds to God, both man's individual and collective behavior will fail to have sound basis and direction. It would seem, therefore, to be worth asking, why is this so? Why is it that once this consciousness and conviction are altogether ended or greatly enfeebled, the human character turns to iniquity and corruption? Had affirmation of the hereafter not been in conformity with reality, and conversely, had its denial not been opposed to it, then the evil consequences flowing from the denial of the hereafter would not have been found with such unfailing regularity. If adherence to a proposition invariably leads to good results, and failure to adhere to it invariably leads to evil consequences, then this definitely proves the proposition to be true. In an attempt to refute the above argument, it is sometimes contended that even atheists who reject the hereafter and follow a materialistic approach to life often lead lives that are, on the whole, good and decent, that they hold themselves free from corruption and injustice. Not only that, but also that their actual conduct is characterized by righteousness and benevolence. However, only a little reflection will make apparent the fallacy underlying this argument. For if one were to examine any atheistic or materialistic philosophy or ideology, one will not find in them any basis for righteous behavior which draws such lavish praise from so-called righteous atheists. Nor can it be established by logical reasoning that an atheistic philosophy of life provides any incentive to embrace such virtues as truthfulness, trustworthiness, honesty, faithfulness to one's commitment, benevolence, generosity, preferring the interest of others to one's own, self-restraint, chastity, recognition of the rights of others, and fulfillment of one's obligations. The fact is that once God and the hereafter are relegated to oblivion, the only practicable course left for man is to anchor his morality on utilitarianism. All other philosophical ideas which are expounded are merely theoretical embellishments and have no relevance for man's practical life. As for utilitarian morality, no matter how hard we might try to broaden its scope, it does not go beyond teaching man that he ought to do that which will yield to him or to his society some worldly benefit. Now, since utility is the criterion of all acts, such a philosophy tends to make man cynical, with the result that in order to derive benefits, he will not differentiate between truth and lie, between trustworthiness and treachery, between honesty and dishonesty, between loyalty and perfidy, between observing justice and committing wrong. In short, a person under the spell of utilitarian ideas will be ready to do a thing or its opposite depending on what serves his interests best. The conduct of the British is illustrative of this stance. It is sometimes contended that though the British have a materialistic outlook on life and generally do not believe in the hereafter, they are more truthful, fairer, and more straightforward and faithful to their commitment. The fact, however, is that the tenuous character of moral values under a utilitarian moral philosophy is amply illustrated by the character of the British. For their actual conduct clearly shows that they do not consider moral values to have any intrinsic worth. This is evident from the fact that even those values which are held by the British to be good in their individual lives are brazenly flouted when they acted as a nation. Had the qualities of truthfulness, justice, honesty, and faithfulness to one's committed word been regarded as intrinsic virtues, it would have been altogether out of the question for the elected rulers of Britain to cynically violate all moral principles in governmental and international affairs, and yet continue to retain the confidence of the British people. Does such a behavior of a people who do not take the hereafter seriously prove that they do not believe in absolute moral values? Does it also not prove that, guided by concern for material interests, such people are capable of following mutually opposed views simultaneously? Nevertheless, if we do find some people who, in spite of their not believing in God and the hereafter, consistently adhere to some moral virtues and abstain from evil, there should be no mistaking that their righteous conduct and piety represents the continuing influence which religious ideas and practices have over them, even if unconsciously rather than subscription to a materialistic philosophy of life. If they possess any portion of the wealth of morality, there can be no doubt that it was stolen from the treasure house of religion. It's ironical that such persons are now using the same wealth derived from religious sources to promote an irreligious way of life. We consider this an act of theft because irreligiousness and materialism are altogether bereft of morality.
إِنَّ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ يَهْدِيهِمْ رَبُّهُمْ بِإِيمَانِهِمْ تجري من تحتهم الأنهار في جنات النعيم.
Surely, those who believe in the truths revealed in the book and do righteous deeds, their Lord will guide them aright because of their faith.
Rivers shall flow beneath them in the gardens of bliss. Rivers shall flow beneath them in the gardens of bliss.
This Quranic statement calls for serious reflection. The sequence of ideas presented here is also quite significant because answers have been systematically provided to a number of highly relevant basic questions. Let us look at these answers in their sequence. Why will the righteous enter paradise? The answer is because they have followed the straight way in their worldly life. That is, in all matters and in every walk of life, in all affairs relating to the personal or collective life, they have been righteous and have abstained from false ways. This gives rise to another question. How were the righteous able to obtain a criterion that would enable them to distinguish at every turn and crossroad of life between right and wrong, between good and evil, between fair and unfair? And how did they come to have the strength to adhere to what is right and avoid what is wrong? All this, of course, came from their Lord, who bestowed upon them both the guidance which they needed to know the right way and the succor required to follow it. In answer to why their Lord bestowed upon them this guidance and succor, we are reminded that all this was in consideration for their faith. It is also made clear that this reward is not in lieu of merely a verbal profession to faith, a profession that is no more than a formal acceptance of certain propositions. Rather, the reward is in consideration for a faith that become the moving spirit of a believer's character and personality, the force that led him to righteous deeds and conduct. We can observe in our own physical lives that a person's survival, state of health, level of energy, and joy of living all depend upon sustenance from the right kind of food. This food, once digested, provides blood to the veins and arteries, provides energy to the whole body, and enables the different limbs to function properly. The same holds true of man's success in the moral domain. It is sound beliefs which ensure that he will have the correct outlook, sound orientation, and right behavior that will ultimately lead to his success. Such results, however, do not ensue from that kind of believing which either consists of a mere profession to faith or is confined to some obscure corner of man's head or heart. The wholesome results mentioned above can only be produced by a faith which deeply permeates man's entire being, shaping his mental outlook, even becoming his instinct, a faith which is fully reflected in his character, conduct, and outlook on life. We have just noted the importance of food. We know that the person who, in spite of eating, remains like one who has not partaken of any food would not be able to enjoy the healthy results that are the lot of the person who has fully assimilated what he ate. How can it be conceived that it would be different in the moral domain of human life? How can it be that he who remains even after believing, like the one who does not believe, will derive the benefit and receive the reward meant for those whose believing leads to righteous living?
دعواهم فيها سبحانك اللهم وتحيتهم فيها سلام وآخر دعواهم أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.
Their cry in it will be, "Glory be to you, our Lord," and their greeting, "Peace." And their cry will always end with, "All praise be to Allah, the Lord of the universe." Peace. And their cry will always end with, "All praise be to Allah, the Lord of the entire universe."
This should remove any misconceptions about paradise, which seem to have been formed by some people of frail understanding. Subtly, the verse suggests that when people are admitted to paradise, they will not instantly pounce upon the objects of their desire, as the starved and hungry are wont to do when they observe food. Nor will they frantically go about giving vent to their lusts, impatiently demanding their cherished objects of enjoyment, beautiful women, wine, dissolute singing, and music. The fact is that the men of faith and righteousness who are admitted to paradise will be those who, during their life in the world, have embellished their lives with sublime ideas and noble deeds, who have refined their emotions, who have oriented their desires in the right direction, and who have purified their conduct and character. Thus, the nobility which they have developed in their personalities will shine in even greater splendor when they set their feet in the pure and clean environment of paradise. Those same traits which characterize their behavior in the world will appear with even greater luster. The favorite occupation of such people in paradise will be the same as during their life on the earth, to celebrate the praise of God. Likewise, their relationships in paradise will be imbued with feelings of mutual harmony and concern for each other's well-being, as had been the case in this world.